2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 212, Moonstone-Sunstone Dyad as Metaphor of Wholeness, a paper presented by Maxine Hanks, with a response by Linda P. Wilcox.
Okay, I'm filling in for the chair of this session, and so I'll just get going since I think we're just a little bit over time. Just to remind everyone that admission to this session is by name tag or ticket only, so make sure you have yours on. We're on the honor system. I'd like to introduce Maxine Hanks, editor and co-author of Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. She's a researcher, writer, and editor. She lives in Salt Lake City. She's also the co-author of Getting Together with Yesterday and A History of San Pete County, and she's ghostwriter of God's Greatest Gift. She's published numerous articles, essays, and several poems. She's contributed research or been cited in a number of books, has edited many works by other authors, and was named the Utah Humanities Council 1992 Research Fellow. She was also, has been used and abused amongst this process. She was one of the September 6 excommunicated by the LDS Church in 1993, making her a popular interview subject by media such as ABC Nightline, PBS, CNN, A&E, and CBC. Formerly employed by the University of Utah, Brigham Young University, the LDS Missionary Training Center, and Ricks College as a writer, editor, instructor, or teaching assistant, Maxine has worked in Mormon studies since 1975. She's written for the Seventh East Press, Sunstone, Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly, Network, Salt Lake Observer, Dialogue, The Event, Salt Lake Magazine, and other publications. She serves on the boards of Utah Issues, Utah Pro-Choice Coalition, Wasatch Gnostic Society, SLOC Interfaith Roundtable, Utah Women in Ministry, and the Mormon Feminist Network, which she founded in 1991. A singer and a poet, she enjoys belting the blues as well as canting for Gnostic Mass. And dang, I want to come back in my next life as Maxine and do all those things. So we'll turn the time over to her, and hopefully, oh, her respondent is here. So.
Thank you, Doe. We had to play musical chairs this morning because my respondent, Linda Wilcox, had to fly to Washington, D.C. last minute to be with her daughter, who was having an emergency pregnancy and delivery. And so Brandon, my chair, is going to be the respondent. It's great. We're all just one big happy family. I wanted to, before I start reading some of this sort of, this is sort of an experimental paper in process, I wanted to give some background on it. Some of you may have seen this issue of Sunstone with the two articles about the iconography of the temple. In 1996, my friend Ben Whittle was commissioned to restore an original Nauvoo Sunstone. And he asked me if I would help him at the very beginning of the project to do some research on the stone. The result of that collaboration was a monumental experience for me, pun intended. As a result of that process, to put it mildly, I underwent a very profound personal change and a healing that was significant for me. And I know that I can't speak for Ben. He'll be presenting tomorrow. But it was quite a journey for him. For both of us as heretics who are really outside of the church to come back and work on the Nauvoo Temple in our own small way, he as a stone sculptor and I as a researcher. Out of that collaboration, of course, he wrote quite an extensive scholarly article about the origins and nature of the Sunstone as a work of art and sculpture, and part of his work is in the lead article. And I wrote a personal essay about some of my research and some of my findings. So I'm going to share part of that essay with you today. It's interesting. The sunstone that he restored was put together with an original moonstone. A man had purchased a sunstone fragment and a moonstone. And so he approached Ben and said, "Would you restore the sunstone so that it's complete?" The moonstone didn't really need anything done to it, and then he asked Ben to carve a star stone to go with them, so the three would be together. And so that's what Ben did. And again, this was in 1996 in the summer, long before there was any announcement or any idea about the restoration of the Nauvoo Temple. So it was a really interesting kind of coincidence. When I first went to see the sunstone fragment, only the top half remained with the two hands holding horns. The bottom part with the face of the sunstone was gone. And that was the part that Ben needed to carve and restore. So he had to do a great deal of research to try to understand exactly how that sunstone was created and what the face really looked like. He left to go to Illinois to research, and I began to do some work in LDS archives at the beginning of the project. Later on, after a couple of months, I just contributed a couple of months of research, and then he took it from there and did quite a great deal of research. And if you haven't had a chance to read his article, I strongly recommend it. It'll answer any questions you ever had about the sunstone. It's interesting that exactly 150 years after the Nauvoo Temple was dedicated, Ben was asked to restore a fallen stone. When he asked me to help him, at first I hesitated because I was a heretic, because I'd been excommunicated. Mormonism was a painful topic, and even the sunstone itself, for me, had always symbolized the masculine and a kind of inherent or implied sexism. Nevertheless, I opened myself to the sunstone and began researching it earnestly. And I found personal answers that I had never imagined I would find. Mormonism's Nauvoo period was a manic time when the many influences on Joseph Smith's mind culminated in dynamic religious innovation, ranging from mysticism to masonry to polygamy. The Nauvoo Temple became the climactic embodiment of this intense medley. The temple, like the young church it represented, was an unusual fusion of diverse traditions from the old world and new. Combining opposites and polarities, Judeo and Christian, classical and revolutionary, Renaissance and medieval, the magic worldview and the Newtonian worldview, occult tradition and rationalism, enlightenment and the age of faith, spiritualism and reason, pagan and urban, masculine and feminine, heretic and orthodox, charismatic and institutional. This early Mormon amalgam of dualities and contradictions was energetic, untempered, and rugged, struggling for balance and unable to find it, other than in the construction of this stone temple. The Nauvoo Temple was Joseph's way of bringing his dynamic vision into solid form and materialize his desire to restore an ancient wisdom reclaimed from other traditions. Only a temple could solidify a revolutionary theology and signify a radical new religious tradition. Standing three stories high with 30 pilasters, a three-tiered tower, a flying angel, surely such a stone structure and its meaning could survive and preserve a rapidly evolving religion. Unfortunately, this extraordinary temple lasted less than a decade, commenced in 1841, dedicated in 1846, and then destroyed by fire in 1848 and by tornado in 1850. However, the Nauvoo Temple has now risen again today, and we can see its sunstones with our own eyes. By the way, I went back to see the Nauvoo Temple in May before it was dedicated and went through the temple, and it was quite a remarkable experience to be able to go and see it after having done this research 7 years previous. And if you haven't had a chance, do go back to see it. It's quite an amazing structure. As this temple reemerges, inviting us to reconsider our Mormon origins in a New Age paradigm, what omens does it hold for us today? Our memory of early Mormonism has returned in a postmodern form, appearing as an anachronism. Does the Nauvoo Temple signify progress or regression, transcendence or recapitulation? In the century and a half since the original religion ended in schism and its temple expired, Mormonism has reversed as the world has turned around. Perhaps this temple still offers the same meaning as before, needed now more than ever, a synthesis of duality and diversity, a metaphor for wholeness. Perhaps it captures an eternal round or complete circle of creation. The totality found in this temple and its syncretic design, its synthesis of symbols, and its own life-death cycle may hold a wisdom beyond what is obvious. The Nauvoo Temple illustrated a collaboration of two very different minds, one focused on spiritual forms and the other on tangible material forms in the prophet Joseph Smith and his architect William Weeks. Joseph felt compelled to put his visions into tangible form to materialize as much of the heavenly world as humanly possible and as rapidly as feasible. While Joseph urgently worked to ground the visionary by putting it into structure, William Weeks captured Joseph's celestial views in architecture and stone. Theologically and architecturally complex, the iconography or symbols of the Nauvoo Temple have theological implications and may have psychological applications. The temple depicted symbols of heaven, symbolizing God's divine presence dwelling in our midst. Sun, moon, stars, clouds, angel, trumpets, and the all-seeing eye of God. The Nauvoo Temple was a system of symbols that perhaps we have never yet fully understood. Rather than isolate one symbol, such as the sun, we might consider and interpret each symbol as part of a larger system or cosmology. Even a simple duality of two symbols, or a dyad of complementary symbols, can constitute a wholeness or completion. Totality can be found in one duality. Thus, one way to access the totality and complexity of the Nauvoo Temple is to simply consider its central concept of duality, which expresses the dual nature of our existence as spiritual and physical. A temple is a structure based on duality, the mortal and the immortal. At the same time, a temple symbolizes the union of these two opposite modes or natures. I think that the most basic symbol of that duality in the Nauvoo Temple is the timeless dyad of the sun and the moon. These are easily seen in the Nauvoo Temple's pairing of the sunstone and moonstone. The enigmatic sunstone of the Nauvoo Temple held a position of prominence in the architecture of a new religion. But what of the moonstone, the pedestal upon which the other stones rested? The sunstone and moonstone were linked together as the pedestal and capital of one pilaster or implied pillar, making a balanced construction or one integral whole. The sunstone is a Mormon icon, a symbol of theological mystery, and a logo for open inquiry in Mormon studies. Yet we shouldn't forget its companion, the moonstone. Nor should we forget the temple's larger cosmology. Rather than isolate the symbol of the sunstone, we can view it as part of a system that includes the moon and other celestial images. What can we learn from these symbols of duality and cosmology? And can the Nauvoo Temple tell us more about our religion and ourselves? I think the Nauvoo Temple has a great deal more to say than even Joseph Smith imagined. A symbol transcends language, and thus it can capture or embody more than one concept or idea. A symbol speaks to our psyche in ways that words cannot communicate, conveying images, ideas, archetypes, personas, memories, glimpses, shadows, sensations, and forms that speak to our unconscious or might resonate to our higher mind. The universal or cosmic nature of symbolism allows a symbol or an image to convey far more than the visionary or artist who created it ever intended. One way to view the Nauvoo Temple and its iconography or symbols, system of symbols, is to try to ascertain what Smith and Weeks were trying to do or trying to create. Another approach to the Nauvoo Temple is to explore the temple's effect upon our own psyche and recognize this process as a personal alchemy, allowing our minds, our own minds, to merge with that structure and its symbols and see what comes forth within ourselves. I explored both approaches to the Nauvoo Temple, and I want to share with you some of what I found. First, early Mormonism developed an iconography based on sun, moons, and stars. What was Joseph Smith's inspiration for this symbology? Joseph borrowed from many sources as diverse as almanacs, astrology, scripture, masonry, gravestones, public buildings, and patriotism, focusing on the most universal symbols of sun, moon, and stars. Mormon symbolism finally and fully arrives during the Nauvoo period and reaches its peak. This notion is fully explored in Alan Roberts' essay published in Sunstone years ago called Where Are the All-Seeing Eyes, in which he describes some of the symbols and how they all came together. It really was the culmination of Joseph's career, religious career, and the Nauvoo Temple fully symbolizes that. First, the obvious or the literal interpretation of those symbols is that Joseph equated the sun, moon, and stars to the 3 degrees of heavenly glory, which is an idea that comes from a couple of sources. The preacher Jonathan Edwards preached the same idea, and also the apostle Paul in the New Testament, and others as well, I think Swedenborg. So it was an idea that was out there and that Joseph agreed with and adopted or concurred with. He often used scripture as a basis for his ideas. And there's a strong precedent in scripture for combining astronomy and theology. The Old Testament compared God and his realm to the numberless stars in the heavens. And in the New Testament, Paul used celestial symbols to describe the heaven and God's kingdoms, saying that the glory of one is celestial, another terrestrial, and another telestial. Interestingly, Joseph Smith had a personal interest and affinity for astrology and astronomy, which he cited as evidence or proof of God's existence. His views on the relationship between God and astronomy emerge in The Pearl of Great Price, where Abraham sees the stars and learns astronomy. Again, in the Book of Mormon, the stars are cited as evidence for God. In the Doctrine and Covenants, Joseph's celestial symbols were essential as theological touchstones, but also as physical emblems of the cosmology he was striving to express to the world. In the Doctrine and Covenants, he wrote, "They whose bodies are celestial, whose glory is that of the sun, even the glory of God, the highest of all, whose glory, the sun in the firmament, is written as being typical. They who are of the terrestrial, whose glory differs from that of the church and of the firstborn who have received the fullness of the Father, even that as the moon differs from the sun in the firmament. Wherefore, they are bodies terrestrial and not celestial, and they differ in glory as the moon differs from the sun. And the glory of the celestial is one, even as the glory of the sun is one. And the glory of the terrestrial is one, even as the glory of the moon is one. And the glory of the telestial is one, even as the glory of the stars is one." Joseph Smith also derived a number of his ideas from Masonic tradition. The Nauvoo Temple ceremony and its architecture reflect specific major symbols of Freemasonry, including the sun, moon, stars, orbs, compass, and square. Joseph himself became a Mason shortly before he commenced work on the temple ceremony. He absorbed many aspects of Masonry into his evolving religion. In fact, the Nauvoo Temple has been seen as his own Mormon version of a Masonic temple in many ways. Outside of this traditional view of sun, moon, and stars, Joseph Smith also equated the sun and moon to the masculine and feminine. This is an interesting pairing, which is really significant. Because if you look at the sun, moon, and stars as a trilogy or a hierarchy, you would have the sun at the top, the moon in the middle, and the stars at the bottom, being the telestial or lower order. But that's not how they appear on the Nauvoo Temple. On the Nauvoo Temple, you have the moon as the pedestal or foundational stone, and the sun at the capital of the pilaster. And then the stars are scattered above around the entablature. And so the order is not what you would expect for Joseph's cosmology, which makes us ask why. Obviously, with all of the money that was spent on that temple and all of the time building it and all of the effort that went into it and all the plans that Joseph reviewed and reviewed and reviewed, this wasn't merely an accident. It had to be an intentional displacing or reordering of those symbols. And that becomes a compelling question. And that became almost the central question for me. Why was the sunstone and the moonstone, were the sunstone and the moonstone paired together as a pair, as the top and bottom of one pillar, or as I mentioned, a system, a whole? There are a number of explanations, and one is that simply they lent themselves to that order architecturally, because the sun makes a really beautiful capital at the top of a pillar, and usually the capitals of pillars were ornate, and the moon works well in the pedestal. It could be that William Weeks, in discussing plans with Joseph Smith, advised him that architecturally it works better. If I'm sure that Joseph was really compelled to put his symbols on the temple, wanting to signify the heavens and the 3 degrees of glory. But William Weeks had to integrate those symbols into the architecture and the design, and so it may have been William Weeks' idea simply as the best way to integrate those symbols into an architectural design. But I still suspect from my research and reading about it that there was more. Interestingly enough, there are a couple of sources from that period that shed some light on this, on my theory that there was an intentional pairing of sun and moon as masculine and feminine, as a pair or a dyad. In 1842, as the Nauvoo Temple was being built, Joseph said the following. General Law asked why the sun was called by a masculine name and the moon by a feminine one. I replied that the root of the masculine is stronger and of the feminine weaker. The sun is a governing planet to certain planets, while the moon borrows her light from the sun and is lesser or weaker. Interesting. There's another source from this period, a comment, where one of the, I've forgotten his name off the top of my head, one of the men who was working on the temple he gives an explanation as to why the sun and the moon are paired the way that they are paired. And he refers to the scripture in Revelation. Let me see if I can find it here. Anyway, he talks about the, the ordering or the design of the pillar, the sun and the moon, as being taken or being an embodiment of the scripture in Revelation that says, that compares the church to a woman with who is crowned, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon at her feet and wearing a crown of 12 stars. And that becomes very interesting because when I was doing this research, I thought about that scripture before I came across the citation. And this was one of those moments when you're looking at a symbol and it communicates something to you, and I was trying to understand the pairing of sun and moon, and that's what came to me. And I went to the scripture and looked it up, and I just felt that there was a profound coincidence or parallel there between that scripture and that pillar of sunstone and moonstone. And then later, much later, I found out actually from Ben's research and material he was pulling together that in fact one of the men who was involved with the temple early on reported that that was the reason. When he was asked, he reported that it was an embodiment or a manifestation of that scripture. So that was a powerful coincidence or synchronicity for me. What's interesting is, of course, the idea of the church as a woman, or symbolized as a woman, and the bridegroom and the bride. Anyway, another interesting possibility. I began to see the Nauvoo Temple as a monument to some of the mystical and very rich mystic tradition. By pairing the sun and the moon together as a dyad, that taps into a very long tradition of the masculine and feminine together as a dyad in mystical or religious traditions and occult traditions as well. But I'll get back to that in a minute. I'm kind of skipping around. The star was interesting because it's Well, let me back up. The sun and moon are linked together, and as I said, the stars reside above. And as you walk into the assembly room of the Nauvoo Temple, inside you have that same design. You have actual pillars or columns with the sun at the top. Sometimes the moon can't really be seen at the base, but you have the stars scattered all around the room as if you're looking at the canopy of the sky. It's really quite stunning. And you almost get a sense of the pillars that hold up the church are this pairing of masculine and feminine together as a unified construction, with the stars or the canopy of heaven above. And being a feminist, I couldn't resist, you know, looking at it this way. Because, of course, I would like to see the Mormon church integrate the masculine and the feminine as an equal pair. The prominence and the elaborate nature of the sunstone definitely convey its meaning in Mormon theology. The sunstone has the face, a human face, carved into the sun, which signifies or symbolizes the resurrected human being, the face of the human in the divine, or the divine with a human face, so that the sunstone symbolizes that resurrection or attainment of godhood. The moon, on the other hand, is simple and serene, partly because it was a pedestal, and pedestals are not usually carved with images. And that was an unusual feature of the Nauvoo Temple. Usually a pedestal of a column is just simply round or plain. But it was an inventive use of space to take the moon and tip it on its side and fit it into the moonstone. And the moon face is not elaborate. The sun is quite elaborate, but the moon, and the sun is very animated. The moon is very simple. It's a very simple line, a faint outline with smiling lips, nose, and eye. Yet elsewhere, as in the skylight of the celestial room, the moon is depicted in all of its phases, symbolizing a circle of completion. I am running out of time. I'm going to have to cut this really short. What else do I want to say here? What happens, there's so much to say that I don't have time to cover. But the sun and the moon, what's interesting is that as the Nauvoo Temple is being built, it integrates not only different symbols, but it integrates Mormons themselves. As the Nauvoo Temple is being built, it's joining men and women. The religion in 1842, as they're laying the moonstones, the religion creates the Relief Society. The Relief Society organization for women is created. And in 1843, women are brought into the holy order of priesthood. And 1843 is when they finish laying the moonstones. So you have the moonstones being set in place when the women are being integrated into the religion as equal partners with men. And so that by the time the temple is completed in 1846, women are integrated into the religion as partners with men. That was another interesting parallel that I noticed. A coincidence, a synchronicity perhaps. Another thing I wanted to bring up is that why the sun and the moon were designed so differently. The sun was designed they were both designed based on gravestones to some extent. And Ben has found in his research that New England gravestones were a big inspiration for the design. And what he found is that when the moonstones were carved, they were copying the flat line kind of design on gravestones. And this was before experienced stone carvers from England joined the church and came and got involved in the temple. But after 1842, some new stone carvers came and were involved, particularly Charles Lambert, and they created a much more elaborate carving for the sun. Another thing that's interesting is that later when the Nauvoo Temple was burned and fell, the sunstone, which originally was at the top, supported by the moonstone, fell, and they both rolled together on the ground as rubble. which was an interesting deconstruction of what I was seeing in two different ways. I was seeing that pillar as a hierarchical construction with the masculine symbol at the top, the feminine symbol at the bottom as the foundation upon which the whole thing rested. And, of course, a feminist can't resist looking at that and saying, gee, the church, in a way, is constructed after that pattern with the masculine at the top and the feminine supporting the structure, holding the whole thing up. But at the same, and it's interesting because when the Nauvoo Temple fell, they were equal partners of rubble on the ground. So that hierarchical construction fell. And when, in 1996, when Ben was working on restoring the stones, when he finished them, they were displayed in a glass case for some time, side by side, so that you had the sunstone side by side with the moonstone. And, of course, I found that compelling because I thought, really, you could see an entire temple in the existence of those two stones paired side by side. Simply in the balance of the masculine and the feminine as equal partners, you have an entire temple in that pairing. Also, the pairing, whether they're side by side or whether they're paired as pillars of the temple, it taps into, as I said, a very long mystic tradition of the dyad of masculine and feminine constituting balance, transcendence, wholeness. And I came up with a number of sources that I don't have time to share from Hermeticism, alchemy, Kabbalah, and astrology that all use that pairing of sun and moon together to signify wholeness, as you would see in the yin and yang symbol of the Taoist philosophy. So that pairing of sun and moon is a universal dyad that signifies the balance of all opposing forces. All dualities come together and working together. And so I see in that pillar that potential. And one last thing I want to say before I've got to close is that I found it profound that the Kabbalah, if you're familiar with the Kabbalah is the symbol or the paradigm for the Kabbalah is the Tree of Life. And the Kabbalistic Tree of Life has three pillars. And one pillar is masculine, one pillar is feminine. They illustrate two extremes. And the central pillar brings those extremes together and unifies them in balance. And the central pillar of the Kabbalah has the earth at the bottom, the moon next, which is called foundation, the sun next, and the crown of God at the top. So that the structure of the pillar, central pillar of balance of Kabbalah, is precisely that of the Nauvoo and Salt Lake Temple. The Salt Lake Temple repeats that pillar and adds the earth. So that the Nauvoo Temple has moon, sun, and stars. The Salt Lake Temple has earth, moon, sun, and star, exactly as they're depicted in Kabbalah. So for me, I guess to summarize, it became a very profound symbol of the potential of Mormonism to integrate and balance masculine and feminine elements, the potential that is there. If we will only let it do its work on us and allow ourselves to see it and allow ourselves to become that potential, I do think that the church and we ourselves have that potential. And I experienced that myself. And I experienced, I have to say, quite a personal healing as a feminist heretic working on this project and then seeing the temple take shape. I think it's there. I think it's implied. And it's my hope that Mormonism can transcend its sexism and its hegemony and its oppressive hierarchical nature and embrace its own potential for balance and wholeness. Thank you.
Caught me off guard, Max. I'm not prepared to be a respondent or even with a pen to make notes. But a few ideas occurred to me as I was listening. When you refer to the sun and the moon symbols, I get the idea that sometimes you're talking about those symbols as representing male and female in terms of gender. I have a thought about the idea that both the feminine and the masculine are innate in both of us, as I know you appreciate. I wonder if what you're getting at is more the idea that in the church we would do well to understand and appreciate feminine strength better, or I should say women's strengths better. Or is it more the case you're suggesting to us that we learn to integrate both of those impulses within each of us individually? I mean, I feel as though those two symbols represent the potential that each of us has within us to be both the sun and the moon, which is really, for me, the source of consciousness and then the reflector of consciousness. And so to become become whole with that dyad, to become a balanced sphere, it would be to perfectly reflect the source of consciousness with our own reflector. And so that's where I go with this. And I just wonder if you can hear me that way, and if you appreciate it that way too. She says yes. Okay. Are there any other questions? Yes.
Thanks. I will. I'll address. Judy Dushku just asked if there was any discussion or response to my interpretation. You know, they didn't know about it, and that's an interesting question that you pose, because Ben and I had both done enough preliminary research, really the groundwork, before the temple project got started. We both, I think, had an opportunity. I know he did, and I could have if I had pushed it, to work on the project and perhaps be paid by the church, but he and I both had personal dilemmas about doing that, so we didn't, and I can't speak for him. So really, Ben's paper, his paper was circulated up at the church and was a topic of conversation, but I didn't submit mine, so mine hasn't really been heard or seen by the public at large. Sunstone, this issue of Sunstone is really the first time that my ideas on this have come out, and so I want to really finish formulating them and then maybe publish them, but it hasn't been responded to yet because people aren't really aware of this interpretation. What I experienced out at Nauvoo when I was out there was a lot of missionaries and a lot of guides walking around asking, what does this mean? What are these symbols? And I was talking to a few of them and they began asking me, you know, who was ostensibly a tourist. So I think there's a great need for some interpretation of the Nauvoo Temple, and hopefully Ben's work and mine and maybe others will help. Right now we have books that describe the structure but don't really interpret it. So, good question. Also, to respond to Brandon's, yes, I didn't get that far. I gave about one half of this paper, but where I go with this paper is in talking about how, of course, the polarized dualities that we see around us in male and female or gendered masculine, feminine, these tell us that we live in a realm of duality and that our purpose is to try to integrate the two. So yes, when I use symbols and extremes and polarities as ways of getting at a concept or talking about it, what I'm really talking about is integrating those in my own psyche and in myself, because I do think that as dual beings, we are not only spiritual and physical, we are masculine and feminine. We are all dualities, and I do very much integrate the masculine and feminine in myself, but that was an excellent response, an excellent comment. Other questions? Very interesting. The sun as the prophet and the 12 moons as the apostles. Of course, there are 13 moons, and then, but that's interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. And you could look at 13 apostles, actually, both in early Christianity and in Mormonism. Suzy Young Gates was sometimes referred to as the 13th apostle, as were other women. And in the early church, of course, you have Mary Magdalene as the 13th apostle, depicted actually in medieval art. There's a lot of medieval art and carvings where you'll see 13 apostles and one looking feminine, which is kind of interesting. Also with sun and moon, a really important part of this that I didn't have time or didn't get to because I wanted to leave time for interaction, is that the sun, of course, can signify the conscious part, the consciousness, the manifested self. The moon can symbolize the unconscious, the depths. The sun can be the heights of the psyche, and the moon, the depths. The sun and moon have applications to the psyche as well as other things. And the unknown. The hidden, the unknown, the mysterious, the unconscious, the dark. Those things we fear, those things we repress, those things we deny. I've got a whole section of the paper where I talk about that, and Jung, looking at it from a Jungian point of view, with the sun as the ego, and, well, that's actually Freudian, but with the sun as the conscious part and the moon as the unconscious, or the sun as the ego and the moon as the id, as Freud would say. Mm-hmm. That's interesting you would say that. The idea of the sun and moon as corresponding to the face. In the Hermetic tradition, it sees the sun and the moon as symbols of the dual nature of human existence, two opposite natures that seek resolution or harmony in the self via a mysterious marriage. Hermes imagines man as a microcosm. All that the macrocosm contains, he also contains. The macrocosm has sun and moon. Man has two eyes, and the right eye is related to the sun, and the left eye to the moon. There, then, is what they call the cosmic image. So, interesting. Other questions? Ideas? Judy? Again, an interesting question. Judy asks if there was any connection between the moon on the temple and any mention of the feminine or women's groups or any acknowledgement by women's groups of... No, I didn't see any. I don't know of anybody who has talked about that other than myself. And for me, it was the foremost aspect when I first started looking at the Nauvoo Temple because I came at it from a feminist theory perspective. And also a feminine spirituality, which, as you mentioned, revolves around the moon. So, of course, I was immediately... And I couldn't help looking at the pagan aspects. You know, Joseph Smith was very involved in paganism and magic and occult, and he understood those symbols. And so, again, I think there was some discussion of that. Another reason why I think that he was aware of the pagan and occult aspects is because the star on the Nauvoo Temple is both... Well, in the first place, it's a pentagram. You actually have the star appearing in three ways. You have the star appearing as a carved relief, a five-pointed star that's a carved relief that is almost a symbol of American independence in the Revolutionary War. You see the five-pointed star as a carved relief, right side up, on all kinds of buildings. It's a common architectural symbol in the 1800s, and it's often paired with the eagle. In fact, on Joseph Smith's home, on his... the rain pipe, you've got an eagle with a five-pointed star, symbols of the revolution and independence. And so that same star that you see on a lot of buildings appears on the Nauvoo Temple, the five-pointed carved relief, but you also see the star depicted as a pentagram, which is an occult or magic symbol. And Joseph Smith was very accustomed to casting circles and pentagrams in the 1820s, learning that from his father. The casting of circles and looking for water and buried treasure and seer stones. He was very knowledgeable about the occult and astrology. And what's interesting is you also see the pentagram and the star both right side up and inverted on the temple. And that's led to a lot of speculation. Why do we have an inverted pentagram on the temple? Because in magic or paganism, the inverted pentagram is usually associated with satanic aspects, or really dark aspects. And that's an interesting question. People speculate about that. Why? You know, the most obvious interpretation is just simply that that symbolizes the celestial kingdom, the lowest order. But still, you know, it does make you wonder. What's interesting is that you have both. You have a balance of the right side up pentagrams and the upside down or inverted pentagrams. You really have a balance. And I tend to look at that again as this attempt to convey the opposite poles working together in a balance of darkness and light. And I see a kind of hermetic or alchemical message there, that darkness and light work together. And you see it in the Salt Lake Temple, on the Salt Lake Temple. Some of the stars are right side up and some of them are inverted. And in fact, you see the star and the eagle again. The Eagle Gate in Salt Lake, when you go by, be sure and notice there's this huge, imposing, dark, almost gothic-looking eagle perched upon something that looks like a keystone, but it's in metal. And there's a star, a five-pointed star, but it's upside down, it's inverted. So you have that same symbol of independence that was so common repeated out here with the inverted star. So, you know, who knows? I think the important thing is that we consider these symbols and we let them work on us, and we, as I mentioned, we do our own alchemy with the symbolism so that we can do something with what Joseph Smith left for us. I mean, why leave it where he left it? Why not take it further? I mean, Joseph Smith couldn't do everything within his short time span. I think our responsibility as individuals is to take the religion and really let it work on us and take it further. Exactly.
So we're from Mars.
That's an excellent question, Kathy. So Kathy asks, is there a problem associating the masculine with the sun and the feminine with the moon, as general law reports Joseph did, and does that not limit the woman to the weaker, the darker, the inferior, and privilege the man as superior? Lori, did you have a question that goes along with that? Lori Winder. Right. So Lori follows up Kathy's question with that it bothers her that the masculine and feminine, again, are equated with sun and moon and with gender. That the sun and moon are equated with gender. Actually, what you're both saying is true, that there is this polarizing and this kind of stereotyping and a kind of hegemony that happens any time. And this is what postmodernists and feminists and deconstructionists are talking about. They're saying that anytime you assign anytime you use a duality and assign one group of people or one gender to one side of that duality, and you assign the other gender to the other side of that duality, there is a dichotomy, a false dichotomy, and there is a privileging. Usually one is privileged over the other. And so deconstructionists and postmodernists, that's what they do. They look at, the way they look at the world is, well, let's look for these dualities and then let's see what is being privileged and then let's reverse that privileging. So that's what deconstruction is. Deconstruction is a three-part process of identifying a duality, seeing what is privileged, and then reversing the two. And what's interesting is sometimes postmodernists and deconstructionists, and I'm one of them, tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater. They tend to see duality as what's bad or wrong itself. And it's not really the duality that's bad, it's the privileging and the hegemony. What happens with deconstruction, I see a parallel between deconstruction and alchemy. In alchemy, which is an old occult tradition, in order to create a new substance or combine two elements, first you have to separate them into two separate elements, and then you recombine them in a new way. So the value that I see in identifying polarities or dualities and going with that for a little while, because I had to do that with this project. I had to just let myself kind of go with it. because I had a huge resistance to it at the beginning. But I just went ahead and submitted to it and let it do its work on me. And what I discovered was that by going ahead and immersing myself in those symbols and letting them just be what they were, that they actually had a higher wisdom and that they actually did tend to reverse themselves and that they did work together, such that the way that you get to that synthesis or that deconstruction is by first seeing the symbols for what they really are and then integrating them or combining them so that they become the means by which you actually transcend. Without that, as Joseph Smith said, opposition in all things, without that dynamic tension, you can't get to that transcendence. And this is a very ancient mystical principle that's in the Tao. It's seen in the Gothic cathedrals, the concept of the flying buttress, the concept of perfect opposition or tension coming together enables transcendence. It was the invention of the flying buttress in architecture that allowed the Gothic cathedrals to climb to new heights that they could never have reached because of that perfect opposition in the structure. So there's a mystical principle there that when you do bring these two opposites together, that you are capable of a transcendence beyond what you had with either one alone. But the principle is that they have to come together in equal opposition. If they're out of balance, if there's a hegemony, if there's a privileging, you don't have the tension. You can't have that tension. And that's what I saw when I saw the sunstone and the moonstone displayed side by side. Because I went from doing research on the temple to seeing the finished product side by side, and that's when it hit me that there's the dynamic tension. There's an entire temple in the placing of two stones side by side. And I commented to Ben when I saw them, I said, you know, there's no need to rebuild the Nauvoo Temple. The whole temple's right here in these two stones. And this was before we knew about the announcement to rebuild the temple. So, as I said, I hate to see postmodernists throw the baby out with the bathwater, because it's not the duality that's evil. It's the hegemony and the imbalance that's evil and destructive. And once you bring the two opposites or the two poles or the two stereotypes together in a perfect tension, suddenly, transcendence is possible. And you transcend patriarchy and feminism, which co-construct each other. You transcend the dichotomy. And that can be seen if you look at it from a Jungian perspective, one being consciousness, one being unconsciousness. When you make the unconscious conscious, or in the Gnostic scriptures, when you make the above like the below, and the male like the female, and the inside like the outside, then you enter the kingdom. So I think there's a profound mystical principle there that we only get to if we just go ahead and work with it and not throw the whole thing out. I hope that. Another question? We have one more minute.
I was back in Nauvoo about a week before the dedication. And one thing I noticed,
the recumbent, a traditional Angel Moroni on the Nauvoo Temple, and also the notion that the explanation given to you was that the recumbent would resemble the cross. Gosh, there's so much I can say about that. How can I summarize that in 1 minute? There's a lot of discussion about the angel. The upright angel, of course, represents the contemporary LDS Inc., you know, church. As I call it, the Orthodox faction of Mormonism. And it was decided that that's the one that needed to be there. The recumbent angel had too many problems, the main one being that it was clothed in temple clothing or Masonic. It had the Masonic clothing on and had the compass and square, and so there was too much of a parallel or connection to Masonry was one of the reasons. But that it's interesting, the explanation given to you is similar. It indicates the kinds of speculation that I see going on in Nauvoo, which I think is fascinating, because all of these LDS, you know, conservative LDS people are going back there and encountering this incredible temple and trying to figure out what it means, and it's doing all kinds of interesting things to their own psyche. And they're coming up with, wow, that would be a cross. I mean, somebody invented that. I haven't heard that. But it's fascinating because, in fact, you know, the symbol of traditional Christianity is the cross, whereas Mormonism rejects the cross, and the symbol of Mormonism is Moroni. So Moroni really is sort of the Mormon cross, in a way. I like the cross. I wear the cross because, to me, it symbolizes the coming together of the two opposite modes, the two dualities in perfect balance, which is what I was talking about earlier. the physical or material plane and the heavenly, the finite and the infinite. So, but that's interesting, the idea of Moroni, the recumbent Moroni as a cross. That spoke to someone's own psyche, and that's what they came up with. We're out of time. Thank you so much. This is Doe. Thank you. That was excellent. Yeah, that was excellent. I'm glad you got here finally.